Scorpius Biomanufacturing offers cGMP manufacturing for biologics entering clinical trials. Translating research from an academic lab to first-in-human trials requires a hands-on manufacturing partner. Scorpius works closely with tech transfer offices, licensing teams, and scientists to help make biological research available to patients in need. Learn more today at scorpiusbiologics.com or through the link in the show notes.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to Autumn on the Air. Today, we're diving deep into the intricacies of working with industry partners, negotiating deals, managing strategic research alliances, and driving external collaborations. Joining us today is Gaylene Anderson, who brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table. As Boehringer Ingelheim's U.S. Director for Strategic Research Relationships, Gaylene is responsible for forging partnerships and pathways for external collaboration with the U.S. research organization, leveraging both internal synergies and engagement with external scientific partners. Throughout her career, Gaylene has been a champion of economic development and entrepreneurship, creating over a dozen startups and staying focused on developing relationships with investor groups and business development colleagues nationwide. Gaylene, welcome to the podcast. We are thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm also thrilled to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, so I want to jump right in. And you've had a really amazing and very diverse career with roles in strategic research relationships, global transactions, and commercialization programs. How has your approach to creating and managing these partnerships evolved, and what specific methodologies or frameworks have you employed?
That's a really good question, because I think about this sometimes and say, if Gaylene today could go back 20 years, you know, how would she think about tech transfer, doing licensing, working with research partners, working on startups, all the above? But I think the number one thing that comes back to me over and over again is I definitely would have spent more time with the scientists, and not just to extract what I needed to know to do a license deal, and just only to understand the technology and how it works so I could explain it and market it. But I would have spent time with the scientists to understand their world more, kind of the things on the periphery, their lab capacity, you know, the postdocs, what other things they're working on, what other things are special that maybe are very different from the technology at hand or could be related to, who they have partners with already, where they went to school, what conferences they go to, all the things that make them successful or drive them in what they're doing. Because I realize now it's this ecosystem and it's not just this one-off thing all the time. And the more that you spend time with them and understand what they're really trying to do at, in all levels, their IP, their research needs, do they want to do startup companies? Do they have postdocs that want to do that? Then I think you have not only more to work with, you build those relationships better. And then when you are talking to industry people, you have more of a full story to talk about. And it's almost the same thing inside industry. When I'm working with the scientists here, it was more set up that way in industry, that people work in teams and the scientists work very closely with the business development people inside industry. And so I just kind of learned that from them when I was, when I moved to Boehringer almost 8 years ago, that they needed to be on this in this car ride with me, in the front seat with me, not in the back seat where I just holler off questions to them here or there. They need to be with me. And I go with them to sometimes their science conferences. I'm going to their department meetings where they're talking about their technologies or their science programs, and I'm sitting there taking notes and just learning. And sometimes it's not applicable to a particular program that I'm working on, but I'm learning more about their science. I'm learning more about what drives them. And I just think in the end, it makes tech transfer professionals better at what you're trying to do. So to me, that's the number one thing that I would go back and do differently, and not just only pay attention to the partnering events and things like that, but also the science events that I could be spending time at. The other thing I think that is super important is spending more time on the front end before you're engaged with a partner. So I just talked about the front end part of your scientists, but now when you want to reach out to people, instead of thinking that you're going to do this shotgun approach where you're throwing, you know, as many bullets in the air as you can and think you hope that you're going to hit something, I now realize that the rifle approach is so much more effective and actually more fun, because if you really do your homework and you're engaged with a partner and they know that you've done your homework and they can feel that, then you're actually probably more likely to get feedback right away. Even if it's a no, you're going to get a why, not just it's out of scope or they just ignore you because they know you or sent them something that has nothing to do with their company. And then you can have conversations and build a network from those people. So perhaps maybe this opportunity for a research discussion or a licensing discussion isn't right today, but maybe it's going to be in the future. And I think that the person on the other side of the table then appreciates you and they want maybe to get to know you better. And you start building that Rolodex of potential partners for the other things that you might work on someday. So those are the two major things that I think, if I could go back 20 years, that would really help me, because I'm guilty of making all the mistakes that I just said were on the other side of this and learned. And then some of the little small things, I think, is coaching the scientists, whether I'm in industry or in academia, more in the front end of how to get the best out of that relationship. So if it is a licensing deal or if it's a research contract, letting them know not just what they shouldn't do. You know, here's the confidentiality section. You need to abide by these rules. Here's the material section. You need to abide by these rules. It's also telling them the soft skills part of it, of how they're going to get the most out of this relationship that will benefit both sides of the parties. And then lastly, it would be if you don't have access to important people that you need to internally, that you're looking for delegates that can be the voice that you need when you're working on programs. I kind of learned that later in my career too. And that's also been very helpful.
I really love what you said. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, the front end work with the scientists was really something I thought was very interesting that you said. And I can hear some of our listeners in tech transfer office is really liking that idea too, but everyone is so strapped for time. Do you have thoughts how tech transfer professionals can make the time to, you know, engage in those and build those relationships a little bit more, given the multi number or the various number of hats that they have to wear in this day and age?
It's true. It is really hard. I think somebody said to me one time, you know, you might be managing 200 to 300 things in your own portfolio.
Exactly.
And nobody can pay attention to 200 things at the same time. I think you're going to be doing really well if you're even managing 20 to 30 of those things. So 10% at the same time. But in reality, it's like 5 to 10 things are getting your full attention at any given time. I think industry does a better job at prioritizing what's important, and then people understand that. In academia, I think sometimes they don't understand that. And they just tell this poor tech transfer person, you're in charge of all 200, 300 things and be successful. And so I think that, again, if I was going back and, you know, I had this happen, and you're always feeling guilty that, you know, 90% of your portfolio you feel like you're just reactive, like, oh no, there's a maintenance fee due. Okay, I gotta deal
exactly.
with that. Or,
yeah.
Or the researcher's then calling you. And so you answer them right there, but you don't have your, as you just said, you don't have the time to sit down with them and be creative. I think that tech transfer people, be more bold. Most tech transfer people are very smart, right? We're talking
extremely.
About PhDs, JDs, MBAs. These are people that are highly professional. They have paid their dues academically to get to where they are, and they should sit down with their directors or their managers or whoever they're reporting to and say, look, I want to maximize and have the best results possible because success breeds success, right? And so if you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off with 300 things and you're not really giving anything its good attention, then you're just going to get what you get. But if you can be intentful to really intentful to 10 to 20 things, and I will make sure that I can still manage what comes to me from these other things, but I need to prioritize what I think is going to have the best chance of success right now and get some early wins. And so I'm going to focus on these things. Or it might be that you have not even a technology yet, but you know you have this superstar researcher in X department that has been a prolific inventor in the past. You know that that person's going to still need attention for a variety of reasons. It could be political reasons. It could be, you know, just because you know that they have such potential that you want to, you know, stay close to them or their postdocs and their other research assistants or whoever that's in that lab. So just looking at the totality of either the departments that you're managing or the caseload that you're managing and really prioritizing, because that's where industry is great. We do that. For example, every week when I was in business development licensing, I'm no longer now, we can talk about that later, my different role, but when I was in business development licensing, every week on a Thursday afternoon, I would sit down with our lead transaction attorney and lead patent attorney in the US and the rest of our BD&L team. And we would prioritize which contracts needed their most attention, which ones were the most important that they spent their time on the soonest, and rank them.
That's really helpful. Being an attorney myself, to know when you're bombarded with a large number of things, which one are the highest priority. So that's very helpful.
Exactly. And I never saw that kind of intent at any institution I was at, even the large institutions I was at, to say these ones are the most important things that need to be looked at first. It kind of was by default that they were the most important if you were close to a license deal or you were in the middle of a license deal, so you wanted to get it done. But there wasn't that intent of, you know, these are the most important for all of these reasons, not just it's close to getting a deal done. And I learned that in industry. And I think my industry partners at other competitors and other companies do something similar, that they want to maximize their resources. And there's a great understanding that you just simply cannot be 100% in everything that you're doing. You just can't, unless you hire more people.
Exactly. Exactly. Which in this day and age is difficult to do. Very, very difficult to do. So
it is. It is. And, you know, I even have discussions sometimes with my manager at Beringer that it's also very strategic. When you simply can't do something, you're not quiet about it. You are saying to them, here's what I'm paying attention to. This is what I'm delivering on. This is why I've prioritized these things. These other things I just cannot do for these reasons, or I will get to them in X time. And if that doesn't work, I need more resources. If you never have that discussion, then the silence is just you're not doing it. But if you bring up proactively these discussions on how you are prioritizing what you're trying to do, then either A, you know, they're going to give you more resources, or B, they're going to know that there's some things that just are not going to get done. And know why.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Gaylene, I want to go back to your role there at Beringer Ingelheim. And I'm curious, how do you identify and prioritize potential external scientific partners? Are there any particular criteria or processes you use to ensure that these collaborations align with your company's strategic goals?
Oh, that's such another good question. I mentioned just earlier, I'm in this new role that I started last fall as the U.S. Strategic Head for Research Partners. And this is a new role within our research organization. So I'm kind of learning by doing as I'm working on this role. But some of this stuff is common sense and some of this stuff is learning by doing. So for example, before I'm working with external partners, internally, as I said earlier, I have to get organized, right? And spend time with my scientists because I don't just want to run around and say, Behringer works with people all over the world, you know, constantly. If there's people that actually want to work with us and, you know, how can they work with us better? So working with my scientists to extract from them and our different department heads. So if it's someone in cardiometabolic, if it's someone in immunology or respiratory, to understand what their research needs are first and where they want to go and where the gaps are in their knowledge that they would like to learn from. Is it early biology they need to understand in a particular area? Is it they understand some things and they want to look for new targets in a particular area? Do they need some research tools or access to particular things? Maybe they know about a particular institution or scientist there that has access to patients or tissue samples or some unique research tools that they've seen published or they've just known about them from meeting people at conferences. I need to understand these things so that I know where to prioritize and spend my time at which institutions. And this is a dynamic strategy that I'm working on. I have this strategy of slides that I consistently present to my leadership team. And each one of those heads of those departments, then when they see those slides, they can say, oh, you know, you could take off this because we're not working in that area for these reasons. Then we've shifted more to this. And now that I'm kind of massaged and teased that out of our leadership, I wouldn't say I'm done completely because, like I said, I've only been in this role about 8 months. I'm getting better now at which partners we need to be talking to and working with who are aligned with our programs. Because, you know, I can't be out there trying to say I'm going to do these unique partnerships with 50 people, 50 different institutions at the same time. With that said, there are always the one-off research contracts that are just coming into our business development and licensing team all the time because a scientist within Boehringer Ingelheim and a scientist at another XYZ university met and they want to do something together. And those things don't stop. My position is more to be intentful and strategic about who we're working with in perhaps maybe unique ways, or it could be simply a master agreement that we know that there are several types of programs there that we want to do. And so I want to put an umbrella agreement in place so that then it makes it easier and quicker to do lots of things. Or maybe it's we're getting together because we want to do a whole program on fibrosis that's going to cover multiple institutions, maybe multiple departments. And how's that going to work and what that's going to look like? That's what my role is to think a little outside the box and how we can find the right partners and work with them in a little bit more innovative, unique ways that we have in the past.
Sounds like a really fun position.
It is a fun position, actually. I mean, at first it was a little bit scary, I guess, because I stepped out of my negotiation role that I've been in my whole career, right? Whether I was in tech transfer offices in academia or now in industry. But I really actually love our site head for research. She's amazing. And when she was talking to me about this position, it made sense to me. She wanted somebody that A, knew Boehringer Ingelheim, but also B, knew universities at this level that could talk about these partnering efforts. And I thought, you know what? We really do need somebody that can do this and be more intentful about how we're thinking about partnering in researching research relationships, I should say, not partnering with biotechs and things like that. Our business model licensing scouts and programs handle those things, but I'm just talking about specific our research partners.
Now, Gaylene, I wanted to ask you, I know economic development and entrepreneurship were central to your work back when you were in tech transfer. Could you share with us whether you had any strategies or programs that you developed to help foster entrepreneurship within academic institutions and bridge the gap to industry?
Absolutely. So this is probably the one area that I miss. When people say, what do I miss at universities? It's always, working on the startups all the time and being around young people all the time, because I also really enjoyed being around students a lot. But the startup side of things became kind of my specialty when I was in tech transfer. Not on purpose. It was never originally part of my job description when I started way back in the day at the University of Hawaii. But I had some innovative, interesting investigators and technologies that I knew were platform type technologies. I was managing the School of Medicine and the Cancer Research Center when I was there. And I was just one person. I didn't have assistants or people underneath me. And I thought, how am I going to get business plans for these poor investigators that have never done this either? So I just one day thought, okay, I'm going to go talk to the dean for the school business and the dean from the law school and say to them, can you give me your best and brightest students that have an interest in commercialization, innovation, startups, learning IP, this world that I'm in? And they said, okay, we know a few students that have expressed interest. And so it just started that way. And then the actual inventor, or the PI, if they were too busy to be involved, I would say to them, I need your best PhD student or postdoc that knows what you know. And then I would take these MBAs, law student who's focused on IP, who wants to maybe be a patent attorney, and the PhD students, and I would assemble a little team of four or five students, and I would coach them. And then I would enter them in business plan competitions around the U.S. and even some internationally in Asia. And I had the best boss then at the time that just said, okay, I will, give you some money for traveling and so on and so forth, because I see how much effort you're putting into this, and we'll just see how it goes. But what I learned really quickly is that if you spend the time, so when I say spend the time, it was like Tuesday, Thursday nights and maybe a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
And, it was outside of my regular day job, things I had to do as well, that I'm meeting with these students to actually create slide decks and pitches and, how they're going to present this to investors. And that takes a lot of work and effort. If you just say to them, okay, here's the opportunity. Okay, go build the business plan and then come back to me once it's ready. You might not get what you expect. And I had somebody say that to me one time when I was at the University of Idaho. It was somebody at a national lab who said, we've worked with MBA students at XYZ University. And it's just, we never thought the business plans that we got back were very good. And I said, well, did you spend time coaching them? And I said, no, they're smart students. They're in these grad programs. We figure they're just going to give us back what we want. I said, no. It doesn't matter how smart anybody is. If they've never done this before either, you can't expect you're going to have this miracle business plan or these miracle slide decks that real life investors are going to appreciate if you haven't spent time with them. So that's the key to making a program like that work. And once you have just one success doing that, then I tell people all the time, I promise you, these deans of the law school or business schools or the science programs are going to say, hey, okay, wait, let's do this again. Let's do this again.
Keep it on repeat, as they say.
And keep it on repeat. And after a couple of years of being at any institution I was at, then I would be interviewing students. I'd have like 100 students to interview every year to only pick the top, 20 that I was ever going to work with. Because you could only, if it's just one person like me, I could only manage, 3 to 5 of these teams in a year, because I'm spending so much of my own time. But it kind of goes back to what I said before, that rifle approach, that then you're more likely to guarantee the success that that company can actually launch or have some success or just get licensed. My goal was not always only to launch the company. I felt like this was a great marketing tool to even just do a license deal. And sometimes the teams did such a bang up job that then it didn't turn into a company, but then a company saw it and then licensed it, the technology. So I just think if you put, going back again also to strategizing, prioritizing what can work, as soon as you have some wins, that really helps you grow programs. And when I was having more success after year one, after year two, then the universities were saying, hey, let's put more resources. Let's give Gaylene some more people so that she can do 10 teams instead of 3 teams. Let's do, you know what I mean? And that's what I mean. When people like to get on that bandwagon of success, and then you'll get more resources to help you. But that's my favorite way to handle startups.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, you know, you've created dozens, spun out dozens of startups in all the tech transfer positions you've had. Were there any critical steps that you discovered or developed over time when it came to securing funding and investor engagement?
You know, I lived early in my career in places that wasn't a hotbed of investors. You know, when I was at the University of Hawaii, University of Idaho in Northern Idaho, Notre Dame and the Cleveland Clinic. And so you have to go to where they are. When I was at Hawaii, I would take these teams or just the scientists. Once the decks and things were built, then I would take these pitches with the scientists and go to Seattle and San Diego and San Francisco to meet with the investors and pitch with them. So depending on where you are, this is a contact sport, you then have to get out and go to where they are. If I just tried to do it in Hawaii, it was going to be really difficult. Or if I was just, you know, in Moscow, Idaho, it was going to be very difficult. I had to go to Seattle, I had to go to other places. If you live in San Francisco, if you're in Boston, then you can schedule meetings across the street and across town in an Uber drive. But if you're in places where investors aren't everywhere, then you have to go to where they are and realize it is a contact sport and be there. But you need to be prepared and you need to have pitches that make sense and that are believable and that look like you have really done your homework on what you're trying to share. The what, why, how kind of thing and the ask. I mean, it's very important. You can't just show up with your traditional hockey puck of, you know, within 1 year, we're going to make $500 million. In year two, we're going to make $2 billion. And, you know, investors see through that really fast. So you need to have a lot of people that have laid eyes on what you're doing. And you need to practice doing that pitch a lot and get really prepared and then go where they are.
So when you were in Hawaii and Idaho, those are two places that you specifically mentioned. I know you also mentioned Notre Dame and then Cleveland Clinic. Was it hard to get funding to go do those trips? I'm kind of curious how you were able to, you know, sometimes funding can be an issue to kind of travel outside of your particular office. So I'm curious how that worked for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It is for some institutions. And certainly in year one, when I was at an institution, you know, there's always no budget. I just have to make it work. And so I just would try to maximize whatever I could do. You know, when I was at Notre Dame, year one, it's, you know, just doing drive trips to Chicago. Or I'm already going to be at bio and I'm really looking for, you know, bio's in San Francisco. So I'm scheduling things outside of my bio meetings. I'm scheduling things there too, or bio's in Boston and I'm doing that too. You know, I'm staying with friends, sleeping on their couch if I need to convince my director that I need to be at this place so that I can get in front of people. So I was also very cognitive of the budgets and not thinking, okay, I need to, you know, stay in an expensive hotel and do whatever everybody else is doing. I just kind of acted and thought like I was the interim CEO of this startup company. And maybe I'm sleeping on my sister's couch, you know, out in the East Bay, and I'm commuting on the BART for an hour into where JP Morgan is every day, because I'm not going to spend $900 a night at a hotel because my institution can't afford that. And so I'm willing to take the pain and do that because I am the interim entrepreneur with no money and cash flow is tough. And how am I going to make this work? So I just tried to be creative in how I could maximize still trying to go do those things. Of course, you know, talking on phone and doing video calls is also a lot easier now than it was when I was doing this 20 years ago and 15 years ago. So I think that also makes things a lot easier. But you you just have to be very prepared when you're doing those kinds of things, because when you're not in front of somebody, they don't get all those extra cues than, you know, through a video conference. But if you really do have something that's unique and you can clearly articulate the opportunity and it looks realistic and believable, then, you know, if you have no money whatsoever, then you're just going to do your homework and you're going to try to get this on a video call. But it really helps if you can get out and meet people, because you may not find that person at the conference for the thing that you're working on, but they might know somebody. So just in talking to them, or you're, you know, at a reception, you're just networking and doing things, and it will lead to other stuff. So just maximize whatever you can. I promise people that once they start having some success, or even just one or two times, then somehow the budgets are found to do more things. And then that just grows. It's like a snowball that you're packing, and then slowly the snowball just starts rolling. But in the beginning, it can be tough. You have to be creative.
I love that mindset that you adapted, which was interim CEO / entrepreneur. So, you know, you're thinking in that way, and you're doing whatever you can to make that startup successful. So, I mean, talk about making it your own. That's really what you did. And that obviously led to a great deal of success.
Yeah, you have to think that way, because if you do, then the scientist gets more on board. I mean, trust me, there were many of scientists in the beginning that I would just have to almost beg them to do this when I believed it was a company, because it wasn't just a one-off licensing opportunity. This was a platform type of thing where multiple products could come from it. And, you know, the person was saying, oh, I don't have time for this, Galen. I have no interest in starting a company. I am very focused on my research. And then that's when I would say, okay, I don't have to use your time. Give me your best postdoc or PhD student that knows this, and I'll work with that. But every single time, as soon as we start having success, as soon as the researcher sees their brilliant idea turned into a story that they see on slides and in a business plan, and then they see the effort that's gone into it, oh my gosh. Now they start showing up for meetings sometimes.
Yeah, they get excited.
Yeah, they start getting excited. But, you know, when they don't see the tangible things yet, it's hard for them to understand what it looks like. And I also believe that if you spend time with a scientist that you feel like deserve this time, because there's so much potential in them, that it may not work for this thing, but maybe it is for the third or fifth thing, and they're learning. So if you don't spend time doing with this, they're never going to get better at how to do it. But if you teach them and show them, then, you know, you hope that over time it's going to translate to something. I definitely cherry pick too, going again back to the prioritizing things. One of my criteria was it needed to not only be the right technology, but also the right team. I.e. the students that I picked to be on the team, but also the right inventor. Because if I felt like if it was an inventor that really didn't want to do this and they were going to block me, then and not be helpful at all, or be against me in trying to do this, then I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. I would more likely look for a license deal for that technology. But if it was an inventor that just didn't know and they had no confidence in it, and they were just like, oh, Galen, I've never done this, and I don't know, and I have so much work in my research, that was okay. I could work with that. And then sometimes I had the ones that were like, let's do it, and I'm gonna, you know, help coach a team with you. And then that's great as well. But you certainly don't want to be beating your head against the wall either with a project that you know from the start that you're going to have difficult people. Because if you're going out of your way to spend extra hours outside of work to do all these things, you want it to be pleasant, or at least mostly pleasant.
Exactly. So, Galen, we've talked about your experiences at Hawaii, Idaho, and Notre Dame. So let's reflect a little bit on some of your experiences while you were at Cleveland Clinic and some other institutions. What would you say were some of the challenges and solutions in driving external collaborations, especially when aligning the objectives of diverse stakeholders?
This is a tricky question that I think most institutions have to deal with, because you are talking about a lot of different factors: resources, politics, personalities, all these things that can come into play sometimes. And I think if you just stay focused on being close to the team and including them in what you're doing, it's really going to help. And if you are at odds with the key investigator right from the beginning, that's going to be a problem. It might be that you need to step out and put somebody else on that project that has a different personality. I did that sometimes. I remember, especially when I was at the University of Notre Dame, you know, once I just had an investigator that my personality just was not suited for this person. So I told my director, look, I think that they need somebody else because I can't, this is going to be two heads butting each other. And he listened and did that. And that investigator did work well with another person. And I was happy for that. And I was also happy that I didn't have to do it. But so, you know, sometimes you need that too. Know when you need to step aside and let somebody else that has a different set of tricks and tools to step in and try to make it work. But if you are all on the same page, then staying close to each other to talk about what are the real goals for impact that you're trying to drive and keeping everybody in the loop. You know, this is something in the tech transfer world that is a popular thing to do, which is keep the scientists at a very arm's length, right? There's a saying that they're just going to cause problems. They're going to mess up the business deal, or they're going to do this or do that. And, you know, that can be true. 100% that can be true. But I have learned from being in industry, which industry never works on anything, not a research contract, not a license, nothing, without a team, including the scientists that are driving the projects. And those scientists are copied on every single email. They're in all of the key meetings. In fact, they're invited to every single meeting. If they can't come, then, you know, I would manage it. In the beginning, it was odd for me because I felt like it was a little bit almost like I was, you know, covering my butt kind of thing to copy them on emails. But I had this great mentor who hired me and said, no, they're super important. If they don't come because they're busy, then that's okay. But you always include them. And I saw very quickly how that made my life so much easier because they always knew what was going on and they could speak the technical talk and be that expert on whatever I was trying to do. And so I try to encourage tech transfer colleagues now and my friends, invite them to these meetings. And even if you think they don't know anything about licensing contracts or research contracts, or they might just go off on a tangent, well, okay, have a pre-meeting and coach them and talk to them. But if you never do this, then they're never going to get better. And so then they'll always operate the same way. But if you try to include them, your deal flow will get better and the collaborations themselves should actually be more successful when people are paying attention to each other on both sides of the fence.
And then there can be no miscommunications or misunderstandings that way too, you know, presumably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, Galen, I want to ask you to look ahead a little bit. And what emerging trends or shifts do you foresee in the future of industry academia collaborations, particularly as it relates to IP management?
You know, I have seen already some shifts in different areas that I think is great, actually, that people are realizing that you can't just be a licensing expert, you're a collaboration expert, and you need to be thinking about holistically what great opportunities you have at your university, at a department level, at a lab level, that would be a great match to a potential industry partner, and vice versa. I think when I started in tech transfer a long time ago, it was just very much thinking about licensing, one-off kind of things. And the startup stuff 20-something years ago was kind of getting legs and traction and going. And nowadays, I think I saw in a director chat thing for Autumn recently, Oren Herskowitz from Columbia and Mark Sedem from NYU talking about how maybe nearly 70% of their licenses are to startups in some way, a vast majority of them for the exclusive licenses. And the non-exclusive licenses are more focused on things that are happening and reoccurring licenses over and over again on the same technology. So for instance, research tools, mouse models, cell lines, things like that. And I think that institutions that recognize this are then putting more resources into the world of, oh, maybe we need more resources that we can do this rifle approach with, putting teams together to make startups happen quicker, to educate our faculty better, to educate the postdocs and the grad students so that they can have better successes, right? You can't just only have the money or the resources or here's some templates. It's kind of like when you're raising children. If you say, oh, I put them in the best schools, I get them, you know, after school mentoring, they, you know, they're in music class and this, but you're not spending time with your kids, then you really don't know what's actually happening. You have to provide the resources and then spend time with them. And so I'm seeing more universities that are starting to operate this way, that put business development offices together because they want that office to be engaged with industry instead of the old model of here's the sponsored research office and here's the licensing office. And if you're doing a research contract with industry, okay, it starts over there. Oh, there's some problems. Okay, we throw it over the fence to the licensing office. They're not really involved in the whole thing, so they don't really know exactly what's going on. They're just reacting to some red lines. Okay, throw it back over the fence. That old model was just terrible, actually. And so the new model that I'm seeing at some very progressive institutions is having this business development office that has people that understand industry, they understand the startup world. And so they are very much engaged in coaching and helping and doing and being relationship people in that whole realm instead of only looking at a contract on a day-to-day basis. And I think that you're going to see more of that in tech transfer. I think that tech transfer has to grow to that model to be sustainable. And also it's more interesting. And if you look at the results and the numbers of where the deals are coming from, that's where the trend has been, and that's where it's still going.
Absolutely. You know, Gaylene, having been on both sides, both tech transfer and industry, what would you say are some of the common misconceptions or pitfalls in the process of working with industry partners that you think tech transfer professionals should be aware of and actively work to avoid?
Oh, I still hear it a lot that, you know, people think that industry, they're just going to steal your stuff. And so if I haven't worked with a partner before, and they don't know me personally, then sometimes I can just feel this guard that's up on them. If that's the Kool-Aid they've been drinking, right? That they, you know, and the people that have been working for a while in this industry or have lots of relationships, they realize that this entire ecosystem is not as big as you think it is, especially if you're just talking about the US, and that your relationships and reputation is everything. So if you're in the business of screwing your partners, then you're not doing well really quick because everyone's going to know that. So I think industry is actually so much more careful about this kind of thing than I ever realized until I was in industry, because honestly, I was drinking the Kool-Aid too, and I was only on the academic side for so many years. But it always makes me smile when I'm in meetings and I listen to our scientists talk so sweetly about the scientists at universities and how careful they want to be about that. Just yesterday, I had a conversation with a colleague because he was talking about a great research collaboration that we had with an institution and everything went so well. And it ended a couple years ago. And then we just found out that results that included our material was shared in other places and other things, that they really shouldn't have been doing that, because it was our material, they shouldn't have been sharing it without asking us. But that my colleague was saying, oh gosh, you know, should we send them a letter? Should we do this? I said, no. You know, this is a good partner. And trust me, scientists or the business people are not aware of all these things. And the scientists are just trying to do their, you know, their projects and their things. And, you know, so-and-so over at another institution is like, oh, we could do such and such project. And they're like, yeah, we have access to this material and we could share and do this. And they're not thinking about the contracts of where that material came from all the time and the details of that. And you know what? That happens in industry too. The scientists, they came from academia, right? So they operate the same way. they are so excited about the programs and the things that they're doing and their and publications and all their partnering that they're doing. The scientists in industry are very much the same as the scientists in academia. And so you have these, I'll call them just accidents, these unintended accidents. But yes, they're on purpose because they maybe send this stuff or whatever. But I know they're not trying to be mischievous or do wrong by their partner. And all you have to do is make them aware and say, hey, how can we put some things in place so we know what's going on with each other? And then we can, you know, give approvals and stuff and keep doing what you want to do, but not treating each other like we're trying to be bad. So that's one misconception. And I think that people have, because like I said, the scientists that I work with on a daily basis remind me so much of the scientists I was in academia. Yeah, I think that's like one of the major things is just treating each other with respect and realizing that unless you're the person that's drafting contracts, you might probably not paying attention to that all the time. And so if you're coaching them, this all kind of goes back to staying close to your scientists, coaching them, making sure that they understand some of these things so that they can try to keep it in front of their brain when they're getting super excited about all the collaborations and partnerships they want to do. But as it pertains to certain material and things, that they're careful.
So Gaylene, as the podcast comes to a close, I wanted to ask you, what advice would you offer to our audience of tech transfer professionals on building and maintaining effective industry partnerships, particularly in the current innovation landscape?
Yes. Well, I said this earlier, this is a contact sport. So you have to think of ways to make these relationships. Autumn is a great example of the annual meeting. You know, I've been going on for a lot of years when they didn't have partnering, and now they do have this whole partnering session there where they have, I don't know how many tables in there, 50 tables or so, that you can book meetings. And, you know, maybe it is just you're talking about things and you're not going to find a licensing deal, but look at those kind of opportunities, not as I got to have an outcome immediately from every single conversation I have, but more of, I need to build a relationship with these people because they might be important to me someday. I try to tell people all the time that I myself try to have meetings where I think of this, I should be on my best behavior like this is a job interview because I might want to attract this person or hire this person someday in something I'm working on, or they might want to hire me. You never know. And so have an open mind about anything, but you have to be out there. You have to take the time to do that. So if you're going to a conference, do some homework, spend some time with your scientists, see who you should be meeting with, the business development people that are at different industry verticals, and make those relationships. And it's great if there's an instant win, but don't think of that. The instant win to me is you're setting these relationships and stay in contact with people. Because if you're only going to people when you need something, then that kind of gets old and draining. But if you are staying in contact with people because you just want to learn from each other and you're sharing with each other, then over time, who knows what that leads to, right? And they will then share their Rolodex. People at universities that have spent the time to get to know me and work on projects and then try to help me too, when they then call me and say, Gaylene, you know, I have this technology. I know it's on the set for Behring Ingelheim, but is there somebody that you know that would be interested, or can you point me in the right direction? And then I will spend the time helping them and to do that. I also try to then counsel my scouts and say, please don't, if you get something from them, just say, sorry, it's out of scope for us. Please try and give them some advice or tell them some things that could be helpful. Like, hey, you know what? We tried this program and it wasn't druggable. And this is why. And give them some information. And so I try to encourage them too, because I think that goes both ways. Our scouts, if yeah, they're out there looking for the right partners, and if they don't ever engage and give advice too, then they're not going to maximize potential relationships either. So I think it does go both ways, that you really try to see this as a long game in relationship building.
Well, Gaylene, this has been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. You've shared some amazing information. You've had a brilliant career. Thank you so much for your time and all that you do for Tech Transfer.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, and have a great 4th of July.
happy 4th.
Thank you, Gaylene, for sharing your insights and experiences with us today. It's been an enlightening discussion, diving deep into the intricacies of working with industry partners, from creating and managing partnerships to negotiating deals and driving external collaborations. And to our listeners, thank you as always for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.